I'm in the studio with Kevin and Cadence from Demilitarize McGill. What happened this morning at McGill in front of the labs?
Well, there was a blockade of a few doors leading to the Shockwave Physics Group lab complex, involving some members of Demilitarize McGill and supporters, both from over the community. This was a direct action meant to kind of show that folks who are against military research on campus are willing to directly disrupt it, instead of attempting to go through maybe the official avenues approved by the university.
We had banners in front of each entryway that was blocked. We flyered students who were in the area, and by succeeding in blocking access to the lab complex for over 2 hours, I think the action was able to get the attention of definitely the people in the lab, the people invested in this research happening, and McGill students and the community more broadly.
Can you talk a little bit about the research that was done specifically in those labs?
The lab complex belongs to the Shockwave Physics Group, which has existed in some form since 1967. The research primarily concerns detonation with applications to thermobaric explosives. The lab has received military funding from U.S. and Canadian military agencies since the 1960s. The research being done has concerned fuel air explosives and their more recent variant, thermobaric explosives, which consist of a type of bomb, simply, that, unlike a conventional explosive, operates in two stages. First, by releasing a cloud of fuel vapor, or in the case of some thermobaric weapons, a cloud of metallic dust, and then secondly, detonating that cloud, which produces a blast wave that is significantly stronger than what happens with a conventional explosive. The weapons are particularly effective in caves and tunnels and bunkers, as the U.S. military has found in its invasions of Afghanistan and Iraq. And these bombs have been used in many wars since the 1960s in Vietnam, all the way through to Afghanistan and Iraq, and very recently by the Syrian regime against rebel-held civilian areas. It's a type of bomb that has generated a lot of military interest over the years because of its sort of like specific usefulness in certain situations. The Americans have even cited the research of the Shockwave Physics Group a few years ago in a committee of the U.S. National Research Council explicitly named the research of the Shockwave Physics Group as a type of research that was needed to develop more lethal thermobaric explosives.
Do you know if Demilitarize McGill has similar actions planned in the future?
Demilitarize McGill hasn't necessarily planned anything specific. Definitely seeing some of the great reactions from some students who members of Demilitarize McGill talked to today at the action, I could see that this type of strategy would be useful in the future. But I think that we're also using some other strategies as well. We've got film screening planned for the future, some workshops coming up, etc. If anyone wants to keep more up to date with events that we have planned, you can check out our website, demilitarizemcgill.com.
Thank you for coming in.
Thanks.
Thank you for having us.
At the same time as unprofitable sectors of the McGill University suffer cuts, partnerships with armies and contractors like McGill's Computational Fluid Dynamics Lab in the Department of Mechanical Engineering advance at full speed. Demilitarize McGill wants to interrupt McGill University's history of complicity in war and colonialist violence by ending military research at McGill. I spoke with Isaac Statham and Kevin Paul from Demilitarize McGill, who talked about their recent uncovered information and why military research should not have a space at McGill University or in the academic world.
Firstly, we have been looking into a series of research projects that took place in the fairly recent past, in the past decade, in the Department of Electrical and Computer Engineering, with direct application to missile guidance technology and missile defense, including in the Israeli Iron Dome system. that was being deployed and developed over the same period of time. The main researchers were a professor named Hannah Michalska and her PhD student Danny Dion. And we found that it began in around 1999 with a project that received $230,000 in Canadian military funding, the purpose of researching the fusion of data from multiple types of sensors aboard an aircraft for a surveillance aircraft. And this evolved over the years that followed with a number of conference papers and research projects with titles such as Guidance Laws for the Stabilization of Missile Trajectories, research with very clear military applications that was also being done in collaboration with a defense contractor, Lockheed Martin, which sells over 20 distinct guided missile products to the U.S. military mainly, and that's a company for which their missile business segment accounts for $7.5 billion. And annual sales. So this was research receiving funding from military research agencies, but also private military contractors that were benefiting from it in order to develop missiles that essentially would be able to more precisely track maneuvering targets. The specific impetus for this research was the prediction that enemies would begin using missiles that would perform evasive maneuvers in response to missile defense, as well as for the development of better technologies for missiles that could themselves better evade enemy defenses.
Another new area of research that we've just publicized recently, we've done some research and some action in the past on the Computational Fluid Dynamics Lab, headed by Dr. Wagdi Habashi, as well as his private company, Numerical Technologies. So we've looked into in the past as they've been involved in research on drones, on attack drones, development for the F-35 fighter jet, as well as being linked to a contract with the company CAE to create pilot training simulators for drone pilots. And we found recently are a couple of interesting new links to U.S. Defense industry, to the U.S. military. One of them is that the private company headed by Dr. Habashi, Numerical, has been posting job offers on their site. They're looking to open a branch office in the U.S. What was specifically interesting was that they want someone who's a U.S. citizen because they want them to be able to get the security clearance under something called the International Trade in Arms Regulation, so U.S. law that regulates import and export of military technology. The other interesting thing was that the office is going to be located in Daytona Beach, Florida, which led us to sort of the second piece of this new research. In Daytona Beach, you also find the Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University. It's a private university that does a lot of aerospace research, trains pilots who go on to work for the U.S. Air Force, and so on. And there seems to be a building collaboration between researchers there and at McGill, specifically with Professor Habashi and a professor there called Vladimir Golubev. And they've been working on a technology called synthetic jet actuators. It's a technology that allows for a control system in aircraft. So they've co-published on that, and just recently Golubev and some of his colleagues have co-published on how this technology can be applied to micro-air vehicles, so essentially mini drones. And mini drones at the moment are mainly used for surveillance, but there are also proposals in the U.S. to pack them with explosives, use them to blow up small targets, individual people, for example. And so something that's being developed in collaboration with McGill, and Dr. Golubev receives direct funding from the U.S. Air Force's research programs and so on. He's come to McGill in the last year or so to present some of this research as well.
Demilitarized McGill always finds it difficult to tell who sets the research priorities of the lab, because there are a lot of contracts and funding coming from outside companies, including Bombardier and CAE. The exact terms of the research contract are not always clear. Demilitarized McGill is still waiting to hear back from some access to information requests, which could shed light on how the research priorities are set. So, Isaac and Kevin, what are you doing about this at Demilitarized McGill? What can you do?
Our focuses has and will continue to be, you know, gathering this information, you know, presenting it in a form that is legible and something that can be discussed by not only engineering students and science students and people with that kind of training, but by the wider McGill community and by people outside the McGill community. That's why we have our website. That's why we're doing this research and putting this information out there. And what can come from that and what we think should come from that is a much larger discussion about what students and others can do to either build a sort of strong opposition to this research at the same time as seeking to stop it from happening. Past efforts have had mixed success on this campus. In 1988, an occupation of the VP research office led to the first regulations ever at McGill concerning themselves with military research. However, those regulations were removed in 2009 after a lengthy Senate policy review process. I think we should be looking at history and thinking about what worked and what hasn't in terms of building an effective opposition to this kind of research. That's something we're going to continue to do as we talk with students and with members of different communities about how to move forward.
And I think it's important to mention as well that we see ourselves not just as opposed to military research being done at McGill, but as part of a broader struggle against this kind of military-industrial complex, against the kind of imperialist wars that are being fought using drones at the moment in Africa and Asia and the Middle East and so on. But we do think that because we do find ourselves at McGill, it's sort of a good place to start. We're in a particularly good position to oppose this facet of this broader issue.
I think something that we're finding too with all of the sort of new information that we're turning up is that it's becoming harder and harder to say that military research at McGill is an exception, an isolated situation that can be easily reformed out of the regular operations of the university. Rather, military research is a regular and like normalized part of the university and something that is constitutive of the institution and its role in reproducing a set of relationships in society. That needs to inform what types of modes of opposition are privileged, thinking about just whether we can enact a few policy reforms that stop this from happening, or whether it's going to take more than that and different kinds of organizing.
How has McGill University reacted to you trying to raise awareness about this?
In some cases, it's been a fairly silent reaction. In other cases, not. We mentioned the access to information requests. McGill, as you may know, tried for over a year to avoid its legal obligation to release information at all that would give both us and the broader community more insight into the kind of research happening at McGill, how it's funded, how it's directed, that sort of thing. But on the whole, the impression they give is very much not being particularly concerned about the issues they're raising, about some of the problematic aspects of research going on at McGill. Recently, Lynn Thibault, who's the head of legal department at the university, was interviewed by CBC Radio when the host of the show asked if the university was at all ashamed or recognized that there could be ethical concerns about some of the research activities going on. She categorically said no, that the university had no problem with this kind of research taking place on our campus.
In the generally understood sense, academic freedom is meant to prevent researchers from having external pressures, preventing them from expressing certain views or investing in certain things. Having external companies, as well as governmental agencies or military agencies, dictating the terms of research, what is it going to be used for, how should it be funded, seems to contravene this academic freedom and guides the kind of research that is being done at the university. Do you think it's inevitable for scientific research to have a political orientation?
In the form that the university takes today, which is one increasingly aligned with the interests of the private sector and with the military projects of states, that is a trend which has as a fairly natural result these kinds of projects where academic freedom is infringed by the demands placed on researchers by the companies and military research agencies from which they're receiving a large part of their funding and material support for for research. So yes, where the state and private companies increasingly take the place of, you know, assume the position of guiding research priorities, that will have consequences on the orientation of research.
For more information about Demilitarize McGill's research or to get involved, you can visit demilitarizemcgill.com and you can find them on Facebook and Twitter. This is Emily Philipson for CKUT's News Collective.